I'll mostly talk about calculating entanglement entropies in the Sitter space. And if I have some time left, I'll talk about infrared effects in cosmology. Okay, so well, there's obviously good reasons to study the Sitter space. It describes, it's a toy model to describe expanding universes, and we are in an expanding universe. And it's got lots of symmetries. In fact, it's got as many symmetries as flat space. So it's always good to have symmetries to exploit. And so that's the reason we like the Sitter. And in flat space, we study scattering amplitude. So we prepare some packets of stuff, some particles, and then we smash them together. And then we have detectors at infinity. We measure what comes out of this reaction. And this all of this information is encoded in this S matrix, this scattering matrix. So and so what happens in DS? So the causal structure of DS is a little different. So you can slice the Sitter space in many different ways. I'll mostly be using flat slices. Okay, so we'll build up some intuition using flat slices. Okay, so So I think that this is probably very familiar to most of you. So in the Sitter space, you have spatial slices that are where the physical distances they are expanding exponentially in time. And then you can rewrite this in terms of conformal time. It's just a change of variables for the time variable. And then it's got this conformally flat line element here. And so this is just a depiction of the flat slices. So I'll mostly be talking about four dimensions throughout the talk. Okay, so you have a three-dimensional spatial slices, and then conformal time runs from minus infinity to zero. Okay, so zero corresponds to the asymptotic future. And in this diagram, no geodesics are just 45 degrees, and free-falling observers, they're just following straight lines here. So the idea is that the Sitter has an intrinsic horizon. So if you have a friend here and you wait long enough, there will be a point from which you never know what happened to your friend. So it's different from flat space. In flat space, if you wait long enough, you can access information from basically the entire space-time as of the Sitter space because of this exponential expansion of the slices. You have a natural horizon, so an observer can only access so much here. So your past light cone here will give you like information about this region here, but if you're living in this world line, you're not going to be able to access stuff that happens here, for example. Okay. So a few things they're good about flat slices. So there's translation symmetry along the spatial direction. So you can talk about momentum space, and so we usually go to momentum space in these space directions. And so when we fix a given distance in these x coordinates, we call them comoving distances. But physically, because space-time is expanding, what you have is some physical distance that is expanding like r e to the ht or r over eta. Okay? So what happens is if we go to momentum space and you think in terms of a plane wave of fixed comoving momentum, this wavelength is being stretched as time lapses. Okay, so the longer you wait, the more redshifted the modes they get. Okay. So what are the observables that we compute in DS? So any questions? So the objects that we like in DS is called the wave function of the universe. So it's this object that tells you, us what's the probability of, if you take a given field, what's the probability that this field is going to have a certain profile at a given time slice. Okay. So when I'm talking about this, I'm mostly talking about the wave function at late times. Okay, so the way to calculate it is you fix some boundary conditions for the field phi at asymptotic, in the asymptotic future. And then when you impose some boundary conditions in the past, you're basically picking the vacuum, just like when you do the I epsilon prescription in flat space. Okay? So there is a natural vacuum. Well, so the issue of how you pick the vacuum is or I would say it's not like I don't think there is an agreement among different people on how you pick the vacuum, but let's say that a sensible way of doing it is with this Budge-Davis prescription. Okay, so I have to say one thing that these flat slices, they don't cover whole the Sitter space. They only cover half of it. You need two copies of this slicing if you want to cover the whole the Sitter space. This is called the Poincaré patch. Okay, so it's just half of the Sitter space. So we're not going to be talking about the other half. We're just going to impose some boundary conditions at early times and forget about stuff that happens on the other half of space-time. Well, which you could argue that is a problem, but some people claim that you could have interesting IR dynamics coming from taking a global point of view on the Sitter, but so we're gonna forget about this and just focus on the Poincaré patch. So as I told you, if you have a fixed comoving wavelength, and then when you wait, the longer you wait, the more stretched the wavelength gets, the physical wavelength. So on the other hand, if you go early enough in the time direction, if you just go to very early times, this comoving wavelength, it was this physical wavelength, it was pretty small. So actually the mode just feels like it's in flat space. So that's the prescription basically. So you want to impose that at very early times, you have these modes behaving like plane waves in flat space, okay? And you pick up positive frequencies for the modes, okay? If you could, in principle, take some linear combination of positive and negative frequency waves in flat space for your early boundary condition. And this corresponds to different choices of vacuum. These vacua are called alpha vacua. They were described in the 80s by Motola and Allen. But I won't be talking about alpha vacua. There are some hints that perturbation theory around the alpha vacua is ill-defined. So I'll mostly be talking about this Bunch-Davis, Hartle, Hawking, Chernikov, Tajirov vacuum. It's okay, so we're computing this wave function at late times, okay? And the idea is that these comoving wavelength modes, they're all way outside the horizon when you actually evaluate the wave function, okay? And the physical distance from which you want to compare the wavelength is just the Hubble radius. So if the physical wavelength is much bigger than the Hubble radius, then you say that the mode is outside of the horizon. And so that means basically that this wave function of the universe is just computing super horizon correlations. So correlation between modes that are way outside of the horizon. So in principle, they're not accessible to a local observer, okay? Because you're just computing information about modes whose wavelengths are extremely big compared to the patch in which you live. So you could wonder, why do we care? It's because this is not something that an observer that lives in the sitter space can make an experiment and probe these objects or calculate something in his world line that this object is useful for. So why do you use it? So the reason for that is because there was inflation. So we believe there was an inflationary period in the early universe. And then inflation ceases. Okay, so there's some reheating surface here. And even though we can just take the point of view that this is the De Sitter space we're interested in. We know that inflation was to some good approximation quasi De Sitter. So we take the point of view that for this patch here of space-time, we can approximate it by the Sitter space. And then at reheating, we observe some super horizon modes. But then much later, you have the CMB being formed here. And now we observe the CMB. And a nice outcome of inflation is that it actually predicts the scale invariant spectrum for temperature fluctuations. You can relate this spectrum of temperature fluctuations to the spectrum of curvature fluctuations here during this inflationary epoch. So that's the reason why. That's one of the, of course, inflation was designed for different reasons. But this was a very welcome addition to the leverage that you gain by using inflation as a paradigm. So you can actually explain the features of the CMB fluctuation spectrum by using inflation. And the idea is that we're here. So even though, so if you remember the earlier picture, you have a late time surface here. And then you could only observe stuff that happens here in your past light cone. So in principle, you cannot observe these super horizon fluctuations. But you don't live in the inflationary period. We live right here. So our light cone has access to like the CMB here. And it actually has access to these super horizon modes. Okay, so that's the reason why we study these. And of course, there is this separation of scales between, when you have very short wavelengths, you feel almost like as if you're in flat space. And then for very long wavelengths, you start really feeling the effects of curvature. So another good reason to study these super horizon modes is that you're actually probing this curved geometry of space-time. Okay, so this is just an introduction, I guess, some motivation for why we study these super horizon fluctuations. And now I'm going to focus a good part of the talk actually computing something in this context. And what we want to compute are entanglements, entropies in the Sitter space. Okay, so any questions? Okay, so let me define entanglement entropy. So if you weren't introduced to the concepts, the idea is quite simple. So you take some slice in your spacetime, and then you take some entangling surface, and you want to see four given states on this surface, and the choice of let me maybe draw a picture. So, okay, so you have a slice. And you have some entangling surface. And then you pick some state for your quantum field theory. And you assume that you can separate the Hilbert space of fluctuations in this field into some inside and some outside Hilbert spaces. Okay? So then you have your quantum state psi, you have an inside and an outside Hilbert spaces here. Let me just like this. And this is your surface sigma. And so the Hilbert space is some tensor product. Of this in and out Hilbert spaces. And the idea is that you're going to trace you're going to trace out all of the degrees of freedom that are not accessible to the entangling surface. So the idea is that you're an experimentalist and you only have access to the degrees of freedom that actually live inside of this surface here. So you're just going to, so you have a, so after you define your states, you're gonna, you can calculate some density matrix by tracing out all the degrees of freedom that live outside of your entangling surface. Okay, so you have some density matrix, and from the density matrix, then you can calculate entropy. So the entanglement entropy is simply the von Neumann entropy, just trace of rho log rho for this density matrix here. Of course, you can, if you can actually calculate this density matrix, then you can extract a lot of information out of it. You can extract other traces, what people call Renyi entropies, which are just traces of powers of this matrix, etc. So it's just capturing really how entangled the inside is with the outside for a given surface. Okay. So because you're in quantum field theory, you need to introduce some regulator here, because otherwise state just points that are like right behind or right by the surface, they're highly entangled, and this entanglement entropy, it actually blows up. So you need to regulate this, and it was, I guess, an early source of confusion, because people expect this entanglement entropy to be some next leading order correction to black hole entropy. And but it's infinite, so you have to make sense of it. All right, so okay. So this part was work I did with Juan Maldacena. So there's just a lot of literature on calculating entanglement entropy for the vacuum and for different geometries or for different theories in flat space. So we just wanted to, for fun, try to do it in the De Sitter space, see what happens, if you can say anything about the De Sitter vacuum, about this Bunch-Davis vacuum that I described. And but of course, the point is that if you really want to probe the De Sitter geometry, then you want your surface to be very big, actually bigger than the size of the horizon. Because otherwise, you're really just almost like in flat space. Okay. So the surface that we take for simplicity is just a sphere. So you take a spherical entangling surface of fixed comoving radians. Okay. And then you go to very late times. So the comoving radius is fixed. At very late times, this surface is much bigger than the size of the horizon. Okay. And then we want to find entanglement entropy for the Bunch-Davis vacuum. Okay. So you can calculate entanglement entropy for any states that you want, but I think it's probably the simpler choice just to consider or to focus on the vacuum. So we computed this entropy for different theories, for free scalar theories, free massive scalars. And when the theory has an ADS dual, a holographic dual, then there is this nice proposal by Ryun Takayanagi that reduces the problem of calculating this entanglement entropy to a minimal area problem. So we also did that, took some field theories in the Sitter space and tried to understand what's happening from the ADS point of view. And that's where a nice surprise happens. So I'll talk about this in a bit. So it's important for me to say that the metric is not fluctuating because if I have time, the last part of the talk, I really want to include back reaction and all the nonlinearities of general relativity. So for this part, I'm just taking a quantum field theory in the Sitter space and taking the Sitter to be a fixed background. And that's it. So you're just doing quantum field theory in curved space. So you're not doing quantum gravity. And I'm just going to focus on the four-dimensional case. So for the vacuum, the structure of the UV divergence is for a given UV cutoff. So I told you that we have to introduce some short distance cutoff here to really separate the degrees of freedom on the inside and outside Hilbert space. So there is a cutoff epsilon. And the structure of the divergences in flat space is very well understood. And in the UV, you just expect that you are in flat space. You're not going to feel really the curvature. So the structure of the UV divergence is exactly the same. And so there is an area law, which was discovered, I think, in the 90s. And then a logarithmic term that's really probing not only the UV, but all distance scales. And in general, when you have this log of epsilon in flat space, well, people just forget about the fact that this is dimensionful. But in principle, if you want to try to make sense of the rest, so in flat space, we write these terms plus some finite contribution. And we focus on calculating this term here. So this term is very well understood, for example, for conformal field theories in flat space. It's related to the trace anomaly of the stress tensor. And so for a given geometry, it's just really proportional to these coefficients times some local integrals that only depend on the geometry. And then this term becomes kind of ambiguous because you really don't know what to normalize it by. But in the Sitter, we really have an IR scale to normalize this log, which is just Hubble. If you have a massive theory in flat space, you could put the mass here. And there are people that do that and then calculates this extra piece here, see if you have anything interesting. So yeah, we called it S interesting. For some reason, we didn't put the E here. It's called S int. It's the interesting part of the entropy. So, so for example, for massive theories, as I told you, you can normalize that log by putting the mass inside of the log. And then you can, for or you can find, there's this paper by Hertzberg and Wilczek where they take a waveguide with a massive field, and then they find some contributions that go like the area.
Can you explain why it's scheme independent?
Why it's a scheme? No, it's it's somehow arbitrary, right?
Yeah.
It is somehow arbitrary. But in the sitter, it makes sense to use H as a.
Still, if I use 2 epsilon instead of epsilon.
Ah, yeah, that's true. But well, I'll say what it looks like in the sitter space, and then it's you can focus on some contribution that's not going to be scheme dependent. Okay. If you put 2 epsilon, the only thing that you're going to get is some number, right? And for the sitter, there is one more thing. That is at what time you're calculating this entropy. So there are, I'll get there in a second, but basically there are some extra terms that are not going to depend on whether I put epsilon to epsilon, etc. Okay. So, and for theories at finite temperature, you just expect this entropy to be coarse grained entropy, to go like the volume. And the sitter, if you look at the sitter, if you write it in static coordinates, you can, and calculate some Green's function, you can view it as some thermal state. So what is the nature? Can the entanglement entropy tell us something about this thermal nature of the sitter? And so it turns out that the form of this interesting piece, it really depends on the time at which you're calculating it. So the late time. So we're always assuming this is at some very late time. So eta is going to zero, but it's not zero. So there's some eta cutoff here at which you calculate the entropy. And the structure is very similar to the structure of the UV divergent piece. It's basically because they both have some local origin, but because the modes are being stretched as time elapses, so you get these new contributions. And in particular, these coefficients of the logs, they're not the same if the theory is not conform. So I think that answers your question. If you just put some number here, you're going to get some finite. This is scheme dependent, but these guys here, in principle, you can calculate. Okay. All right. So there's a nice, I really like this picture. This is the physical picture of what's happening. So the reason why the term exists is because you have particles being created, but because space-time is expanding, we really have at every E folds like new particles being created. So at the late time in which you compute your entanglement entropy, you're really probing all different time scales because you're, for example, this pair here was created here. But then when you trace over the Hilbert space here, you're really not taking into account this particle here. So these are the particles that contribute to this new term of the entropy. The idea is that the wave function becomes a time independent at very late times. So this contribution is really coming from some sub-horizon modes that they get stretched at late times. So it really has some local nature. And the reason, I guess I didn't mention, but the reason why this is the structure of the UV divergent piece is because these are the only local terms that you can write. You could, in principle, write some 1 over epsilon term here. It's also divergence, but there's no local quantity that you can build out of the curvature here, the slice that that can just by dimensional analysis you can't get a coefficient like that in the entropy. So that's the same reason why. So this is just based on symmetry arguments, but we can actually calculate this both for the holographic models and for the free theories, and then we can show that this is actually the structure of the entropy.
Since you mentioned covariance, I mean, H, the Hubble constant, is not a scalar. You can get it from in de Sitter space from the curvature, but the object that's invariant is the curvature scalar. So it's a little puzzling that you're telling us that you expect a covariant answer, and yet the answer is not covariant in the way you present it.
I guess I expect it to be dependent on some covariance quantity on the three slice here. Not really a full four-dimensional curvature answer.
Because on the three slice.
Yeah, so it depends on the extrinsic curvatures of the surface that you're taking, and of course there's so the general form of this entropy will be some function of the extrinsic curvatures on the slice.
How can it depend on them? It's determined by a two surface, and any three surface that you fill that in with evolves to any other one by some unitary evolution. So the entanglement entropy can't depend on how the three surface behaves. I don't understand.
No, I'm talking about the curvature. I'm not talking about the curvature of the slice. I'm talking about the curvature of this entangling surface here.
In a particular slice.
That's right.
Is that an invariant? Is that independent of which slice you embedded in?
Well, You can always relate it to the entropy in different slices by using isometries, right? But the point is to really take some super horizon sized geometry at late times. So I mean, it's related probably to a different geometry at earlier times, but the geometry that we're focusing on is just some. So say this is the Hubble scale, some geometry that is much bigger than this Hubble scale at some very late conformal time.
I guess maybe I don't understand exactly which surfaces you're talking about. So do you first pick a foliation of De Sitter?
That's right. I'm always talking about flat slicing so far.
Okay.
To actually calculate it, I'll go to different slicings. But yeah, so sorry. So these are R3 slices. Okay, of the sitter, and I'm actually just talking about a sphere here. Okay, so the entangling surface is some S2 here. Okay, and the radius of this S2 is much bigger than the Hubble scale. Okay, so if you really wanted to write down the most general form, as it only depends on these extrinsic curvatures. I'm sorry, let me. So the way it works in flat space is the way it works in flat space for conformal theories is this depends on two different extrinsic curvatures. So if you calculate it for say the sphere and the cylinder, then you can tune exactly what the general form of this is. So for any entangling surface, if you choose instead of an S2, if you choose more complicated objects here, in principle, you can calculate what it is just as a function of some universal numbers times some extrinsic curvature integrals, extrinsic curvatures of this surface here. Does that make sense?
More sense.
Yeah.
I think Ted's objection was you're invoking covariance in that formula, and you're saying the coefficient C2 has a very nice covariant form, but then you're sticking an H in to normalize the log, and his complaint is that H doesn't seem to have the same covariant nature or definition.
I mean, why not? Because isn't this just R? I mean, it's R is like H squared, I guess, but.
I think actually it might for the reason that he's talking about a specific set of slices. So if he's considering surfaces that are embeddable in the flat slices, then the flat slices take on a preferred status in the calculation, and then the normal vector field to that foliation has a scalar quantity, namely the divergence of the normal, which is H. So H becomes well defined once he's broken the Diffeo symmetry by picking this foliation and saying, I'm considering surfaces, two surfaces embedded in that foliation. So it might make sense for that reason.
Well, okay, but then it relies on a foliation.
Yes.
Yeah, the covariance of C2 didn't depend on that choice. That's all.
Oh, are you sure?
Yeah. Doesn't matter. Carry on.
Okay. All right, so for the free theories, we can actually exploit a bit the symmetries of the problem. And this S2 entangling surface, it breaks down the full De Sitter group into some subgroup of it, SO31 group. And let me show you some Penrose diagrams, maybe. Maybe are useful to understand what's going on. So so this is the Penrose diagram of the De Sitter space. And in flat slicing, you're just really covering this part here that I talked about. And so these are the R3 planes. And you're taking the entangling surface to be an S2 here at some very late time. Okay, and the idea is that by isometries, if you really go to very late times, if you just take this to be like pretty much here at infinite boundary, you can relate it to a different problem in different slicings of the De Sitter space. So this is really just for the case of the sphere. Okay, so I don't claim that this strategy is useful for different geometries. And because you have a well, so you really want to trace out there's this bold line here. So you really want to trace out all the degrees of freedom that live, say, here. So from these diagrams, it's pretty clear that this hyperbolic slicing is the best way to approach the problem, because you're in this hyperbolic slicing, this open slicing of the De Sitter, you really have two hyperboloids. And you can actually write down wave functions that have zero supports here and non-zero supports here. It's very easy to trace out the degrees of freedom here on the right-hand side. Okay, there's a bridge here that I depicted by this. I don't know. I couldn't draw any better. But there's this bridge here, and I guess that the trickiest part is to show that this bridge doesn't really contribute to part of the entanglement entropy, at least to that logarithmic term. But you can do that, and then the problem really becomes very simple, because all that you're doing is you're really writing for these slices. You break down all of the modes into a set of modes that are eigenfunctions of some Casimirs of the SO31 symmetry. And for each mode, you just really have two harmonic oscillators, one that lives here on the left-hand side, one that lives here on the right-hand side. So the tracing out is almost trivial. So you can actually find the density matrix. So these wave functions were actually studied in the context of open inflation. So when people didn't know exactly if inflation could end in a reheating surface that was flat or open. So they were, these wave functions were already given to us in the literature, like in the 90s. And I have to say that a problem with using these slices here is that so the UV problem comes for, well, maybe let me draw this a bit bigger. Okay, not what I wanted. So this is the Penrose diagram. So we're taking some late time slice here and then join, well, these are the two slices, the left and right hand side slices. And ideally you want your entangling surface to be here, but then when you regulate it, you just move it back to the pass a bit and then you join it with some bridge here along this central region here. Okay, and the problem is there are two things that are blowing up as you take this entangling surface to here. One is the volume of this hyperboloid here, and also the proximity between these the left and right hand side. So there's some mixing between the UV and the IR cutoffs of the theory. But you can actually capture the log. So there are two terms, the log eta and the area term. And this term becomes a little ambiguous because there's really some, so there's this and there's this A over epsilon term. So this eta is basically related to epsilon in some way. So 1 over eta is kind of like epsilon. But you can still find an argument for why you can capture this log of eta term. And this is what the result looks like for. So this is some mass parameter, nu squared. So the bigger the mass, you're just moving this direction from the minimally, so mass equals zero case. This is the conformally coupled case, and this is very high mass. Okay, so when the mass is pretty big, you expect that not many particles are created. So the entropy is just really decaying exponentially with the mass. And for the conformally coupled case, you just expect to get the flat space results for a conformal field theory. The term then multiplies log of epsilon. And then you can, this was computed in the literature by Cassini, Huerta, and Dalker. And then you can check. So this is just normalized, this curve is just normalized with respect to this value, but you can calculate it and it's a consistency check. It agrees with the flat space answer. So there is this bump here, and actually the for mass equals zero, you get the exact same value for this coefficient as the conformally coupled case. So this region is kind of suspicious. So the reason for that is that when you go to these low mass regions, you have some extra modes that has a different Casimir than the other modes that. So these modes here, they live on the left and right hand sides. They have Casimirs, they're real numbers. And so when you go to this mass range here, you have a new Casimir that basically lives here. And then it has some supports here in the center, and then it decays. So it's much harder to argue that that here there's really no long-range entanglements. The only arguments that we could come up with to say that maybe this is still true is that the Casimir related to this extra mode is imaginary, actually. So the Casimir is related to so for both mass ranges you have a real set of Casimirs from say 1 to infinity, but it becomes an incomplete set of states for low masses, and this extra mode that you need to introduce has some imaginary value of the Casimir. So it has some support here. So because the Casimir is different, so maybe it doesn't get entangled with the other modes. But yeah, the fact that this curve just does this dip here,
this is
not
What are you talking? Is this D2?
Yeah, it's D2. So it's the coefficient of log eta.
So it's not S int over S. It's not what you're looking
for. Ah, yeah, sorry. Yeah, it's D2, not S int. Yeah, I'm not including the area term. The reason why I can't calculate the area term is because of this.
You're not even including the log. You're just looking at the coefficient.
That's right, yeah. The coefficient of the log, yeah. Okay, so this is the, you can actually, because you can find the density matrix, you can actually calculate the any Rennie entropy that you want. You can calculate just the full entanglement spectrum. And okay, and for theories that have holographic duals, then there. The task of calculating the entanglement entropy is much simpler. And so there is this, you just use this minimal area prescription. It's called Ryu-Takayanagi formula. And because now the background is time dependent, because we're in the sitter, there is some covariance extension to that idea by Ruberi Rangamani Takanayagi. And so we're going to use that and see what the form of the entropy is for different field theories in the sitter. For a CFT, then just because of conformal symmetry, you just get the same results as in flat space. It's not very interesting. But when you have a non-conformal field theory in the sitter, a specific example that we studied was the following. So you just take ADS. So we want the boundary to be four-dimensional. So you just take ADS 6, and then you wrap one extra dimension to a circle. So you get ADS 5 cross S1. And depending on the radius of this circle, you have different geometries, and you can have these so-called bubbles of nothing being described by these solutions, or you can have cosmologies with a singularity. Okay, so you can do that for ADS Schwarzschild, and you can do that for pure ADS. If you just take pure ADS and you wrap it on a circle, and you just write it as ADS 5 cross a circle, then you can show that you have to remove part of the space-time. Otherwise, you get closed time-like curves. So it's very similar to the BTZ construction of a black hole. So it's called the topological black hole. And for ADS Schwarzschild, when you take this circle and you do some analytic continuation, then you get this this bubble of nothing geometry. I'll show you the pictures in a second. So they're really related to how big or how small this circle is, and so it's related to some deformation parameter. We don't know exactly what the field theory is in this sitter, so we're just gonna take some duals and see what the entropy looks like. So for a large deformation parameter, so you can take this bubble of nothing geometry here. So there's no space-time here. So you just have ADS Schwarzschilds, and this is the circle. So it's just shrinking smoothly to zero here at some horizon distance, okay? And so the sitter space is here at the boundary. Okay, so it's this cylinder here, the boundary, and we can slice it, the sitter slices, okay? And so we take some late time surface, and then the S2 is here, and this is the bulk minimal area. This is the excursion of the bulk minimal area. Then you can calculate this, and you see that there is no logarithmic term. There's just an area law. And this area law is similar to area laws that you get in flat space for a confining theory. Just because there's no long-range entanglement, the theory is confining. Okay? Because this Ryu Takayanagi formula is some leading order in N results, you can just really capture this logarithmic term equals to zero. But if you could go to the next order, then of course there you could probe some quark anti-quark pair that is like that really gets stretched a little bit. And so, but yeah, you can't see that from this holographic prescription. So you just really see the area law. Okay, so you really don't get anything new compared to flat space, basically, for a confining theory. For a theory with a small deformation, so you could take a scalar field permeating here a space, and then you have some small deformation of your ABS space, and then you create some horizon here, so you have some scale factor here for. Well, maybe let me describe the slicing first. So you just take the light cone here, and then you have some de Sitter slicing. It covers only up to here, up to the light cone. So then these de Sitter slices, their size is shrinking to zero, and then you can continue through this region, and then you have some FRW cosmology living here, some open FRW cosmology that ends at a singularity. Okay, so this is very similar to the Coleman de Lucia solution. You have some decay to ADS. And then space-time basically ends here. In that construction that I mentioned about the circle being wrapped, the reason why you develop a singularity here is because if you take a curve and you follow it like this, it changes signature from space-like to time-like. So you really have to terminate space-time here. So now, again, this is the de Sitter slice. This is the late time which we calculate the entropy. This is the entangling sphere. And then we calculate the minimal area surface, and then it goes behind the horizon. Okay, so this is a horizon. It's not exactly like a black hole horizon, but it's still a horizon. When you cross here, you can't go back. But the nice thing about it is that if you calculate this piece here on the let me call it the de Sitter part of your geometry. This piece here is only contributing an area term, just like in the previous case, where the geometry really terminated in some horizon. There is no logarithmic term coming from here. But you can solve the minimal area problem and your solution, because you have an H3 here. Okay, this is the solution, and it's shrinking smoothly to zero here at this point. And the logarithmic piece is just basically coming from the volume of this H3 here. So the volume of this H3 is producing the logarithmic piece. And so what's really interesting is that you're computing some observable here in the Sitter field theory, but you're really probing something about the cosmology. So let me tell you a bit about the cosmology. So the scale factor, it starts growing. It reaches a maximum here, and then it goes back to zero. So it turns out, so there is, and then when you try to calculate the minimal area solution for this surface here, if so, let me, I'm drawing here the slice for which the scale factor is maximal, okay? So it grows up to this slice here, and then it falls down to zero. Okay, so it turns out that the solution, if you take this to very late times, the solution is just a hyperboloid that is really following very closely this maximal scale factor slice. So the conclusion is that you calculate some observable here in the Sitter space, an entanglement entropy, and this coefficient of the logarithmic term is giving you a feature of the what the value say of the scale factor is at the peak in the cosmology. So you're really it is some FRW CFT duality or an FRW DS duality. So you're really probing a non-trivial feature of the cosmology by computing something, some long-range entanglements in the Sitter slice. Okay, I guess I already said that. So let me just finish by summarizing it. So this, we just studied this entanglement entropy in the Sitter, and there's this new contribution that is not present in flat space. And it's just really describing these long-range entanglements of particles just because of this feature of the Sitter where you have modes being stretched constantly. And so particles, they were pretty very close to each other. At some early times, they get stretched very far away later. So this logarithmic pieces in late times they're really capturing these long-range entanglements, and so you can calculate it for free theories, but I think that the nicest result was really the fact that when you have this holographic dual, you can capture some information about the region behind the horizon by calculating some observable for the field theory in the Sitter. So I guess I'll stop here. Thank you. Yeah.
You started by explaining that the natural observable in the Sitter space are this wave function in the future.
Yeah.
When you compute the entanglement entropy, we did not impose such a thing. It's just trace, I guess, of the role of them into something like Keenian expectation.
Sorry, say that again. So the entanglement entropy is a function of this density matrix, which you can determine from the wave function, right?
Yes, but what you did not do is impose some future wave function, some specific wave function in the future. Right.
Yeah.
You could in principle do that and get some.
Yeah, you can do that. Well, that's what Well, that was the second part of the talk. you can use that. So if you want to compute, you can compute the spectrum, the power spectrum of CMB fluctuations. So the way to do it is you take some Gaussian approximation for this wave function, and then you get the scale invariant spectrum of CMB fluctuations. And then you can go, that's how we calculate non-Gaussianities, for example. So you can calculate three-point functions by.
No, what I meant was you can also compute entanglement entropy in the present of the future boundary condition.
Ah, okay.
And then these coefficients become some functional.
No, but you calculate this wave function for some states, right? So if it would just be, you know, like something like this, so some Gaussian wave function. And this object that I presented is basically just the entanglement entropy where you use this wave function here. So it's just that it's really hard to use this wave function to do the tracing out of degrees of freedom. So you write this rho, this density matrix as some psi. Let me erase this. Okay, so psi of phi is some Gaussian wave function. Okay, so you're. So your question is, instead of, so this is the wave function for the vacuum, you want to do it for a specific field configuration on the outside. That's what you're saying, right?
In the future, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you can write a density matrix here for phi out. Okay. So it would just be some integral psi star psi. Okay, so you have to separate this. So you take some entangling surface, and then you have to separate the field into some inside and some outside modes, and then you're just tracing phi out. So you trace out the modes, say, inside of the entangling surface, and then from this density matrix you compute the entropy. So I don't quite understand. I mean, this object here depends on what the field profile is on the outside, but the entanglement entropy itself, it depends on some trace. So you really have to sum over all possible configurations of the field on the outside. You specify the states when you define the wave function here. But if I understood correctly, your question is, can you define some entropy for a given field configuration instead of for a given quantum state? Is that right? Or
QM, we can discuss later. To promote this coefficient into functional. Like in the NDS, you can put correlation functions in something like a specific boundary state.
Yes.
You can compute it not just in the vacuum, but in the Kaplan state and so on.
Yeah, you could do that for different states. Yeah.
Okay, so there are no more questions. That's thanks.